Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Markita Fornoff, a producer here at NPR News, sitting in for Carrie Miller while she's away. Today, I want to talk to you about death. It's a bummer, I know, but stick with me for a minute here. Death is one of the only inevitable parts of life, and yet it also feels like one of the most inexplicable. Most of us are woefully unprepared to experience loss or to help others going through it. And that's where Rebecca Sofer and Gabrielle Berkner come in. They don't have any formal training in bereavement, but they've learned about it the awful and old-fashioned way, through personal experience. And they've shared everything that they've learned, the good, the bad, the painfully awkward, and shared it on a platform where others can do the same. Their website, modernloss.com, features essays on it all. For example, the 9 things no one tells you about scattering ashes, what to say or not to someone who has a miscarriage, and an ice cream truck at a funeral. They also have a new book out called Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, Beginner's Welcome. And they join me today from New York City and L.A. respectively. Rebecca Sofer and Gabrielle Berkner, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
So I have a really big question, and I want to start with you, Rebecca. Why are we so bad at talking about death?
Because we don't want to die. That's what I think. I mean, I don't really feel like it. I don't know about you. I think that our society, specifically Western culture, is very uncomfortable around the topic of death. And so by extension, it's very uncomfortable around the topic of grieving, because people don't want to acknowledge that after a death, there's actually more discomfort, there's more darkness, there's more shades of gray that comes after someone actually dies. It's really, like you said, it's personal experience. At least my personal experience is that people don't want to be reminded that our time here is limited, and that it's only inevitable that they're going to be going through something similar that I went through or that Gabby went through. And so, you know, sometimes people try to brush it under the rug or, you know, talk about anything else under the sun with you so that, you know, the only thing that happens then is that it's so painfully obvious that they're not talking about the most important thing, which is what you're dealing with, which is grief.
I mean, the challenge here is that you desperately do not want to say the wrong thing to someone who's grieving, which means that you kind of either default to platitudes or saying nothing. But there are so many other choices here, right, Gabby?
Right. I think people tend to say a lot of thoughtless and dismissive things to people who are grieving. Generally, anything that places blame on the person who died, their lifestyles or their choices, anything that intimates that grief is something to get over can feel particularly hurtful. People say things, and it's mostly not out of malice. It's just really hard to know what to say. Rebecca and I have a website about grief and loss, and we just wrote a book on the same topic. And I'll only speak for myself, but I don't always say the right things. I don't always know what to say. It's really hard to know what to say. And there's not a one-size-fits-all soundbite that's going to make everyone who's experiencing a loss feel supported at any given moment. So I have some general recommendations about what to say.
And these recommendations are illustrated so beautifully in your book by Peter Arkell, by the way. Do you want to talk about the one with a drawing of two women, and it's titled Stuff People Really Shouldn't Say?
Right. So we have, as you said, stuff, but a less elegant word for that. People say, but really shouldn't, and what they should say instead. So some of the things that people say but shouldn't are, I know just how you feel, or he's in a better place, or at least you have two healthy children, are married, are alive. Was he a smoker? Was he taking preventative medicine? Was he wearing a seatbelt? So any of this that really places the blame or pretends to know exactly where you are in your grieving process can feel really dismissive or hurtful to the person who's hearing that.
Sure. And I want to touch on a couple of those specifically. For example, the I know just how you feel one is followed by a footnote that says it's generally accompanied by a phrase demonstrating that this person absolutely does not.
Right.
Correct.
I mean, do you want to explain why my mother died too or something like that isn't always helpful?
You know, for me, you know, and I'm the one who wrote that footnote, which is why I was laughing, because I was really tired of people saying, I know just how you feel. I know exactly how you're feeling. And I, too, by the way, I'm not perfect. I used to say that stuff, too, to people when they were going through a tough time that I felt like I could, you know, mildly associate with, because I wanted to be there for that person. I wasn't trying to be callous. I wasn't trying to kind of show one-upmanship, like my malady is better than yours or bigger than yours. It's more that I honestly did not know what to say. And it was only after, you know, I lost both my parents within a span of 3 years, 3.5 years, that I realized, oh, it's actually really unhelpful when someone says, I know exactly how you're feeling. Because you know what? It's not inviting the recipient to share their story. If you're saying, I know exactly how you're feeling, you're like, okay, I guess case closed. You know exactly how I'm feeling. That's really not the case. Every situation is different. Everyone grieves differently. Everyone lost someone different and had a different relationship with that person and lost them in different ways at different points in their lives. This is all apples and oranges. So, you know, instead of saying, I know just how you're feeling, you know, turn it into a question. I mean, really, you know, it's not even like putting it on them. You don't have to say, you know, you don't have to ask for, you know, some sort of long speech about grief. You can just say, you know, how are you feeling today? You know, and Sheryl Sandberg was really good at pointing that question out, asking a specific question, you know, like, what is it that you miss the most about them? Or what is the worst thing you're feeling right now? It's really easy when you put the spin on it that if you come up with a specific question, the person is probably going to feel like they can answer it, as opposed to answering really big open questions like, how are you?
Instead of just leaving it open to...
Exactly, exactly. Not like, you know, what can I do for you? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, grief lasts forever. We're not just talking... The reason that we're so excited about this book is that this book is not just for that first 365-day period of time after a person dies. It's forever. You lose someone, you're going to be living without them for the rest of your life. So grief is going to pop up its head kind of probably every day in some ways. Sometimes you won't notice it. Other times you really will. And this book talks about that. It addresses grief over the long arc of it. So what we try to point out in these, you know, how-tos that are throughout, peppered throughout the book, as well as in the essays, that is that these questions are actually germane to ask people at any point in time, not just that first year after a loss.
Yeah, and we'll touch more on that kind of long arc of grief in a second here. But I want to go back to a couple of the specific examples just while we're talking about them. Why is it unhelpful to say, if there's anything you need, let me know?
Well, in my case, I would say I lost my mom very suddenly. She died in a car accident. So I had people calling me. I had, oh man, I had voicemails piling up and emails piling up saying, if there's anything I can do, if there's ever anything I can do. And those were from really loving people. They really were very close friends, very close family members. I had no idea what the heck I needed them to do for me. The only thing I needed them to do was find a way to resurrect my mom and make her able to be with me and not dead. And they couldn't do that. So beyond that, I was just swirling in shock. I was numb for so long, for months, really. And I didn't know the answer. And I realized that what really started helping me was friends and people who came out of the woodwork started helping me in ways that I didn't realize I needed help until they started doing it, which meant they took it upon themselves to send dinner or to, you know, clean my bathroom. They actually did this a few times because I got really bad at cleaning my own place. I just didn't feel like doing it. One of my favorite stories of real friendship was my friend Brett. It was a few months after my dad died and I was having a, or sorry, my mom died. It was a few months after my mom died, rather. And I was having a terrible, terrible day. It was the holidays. It was terrible weather outside. It was New York. You know, it was getting dark at like 11 in the morning. And I just missed her so much. And I was working so hard. And I called him just saying, you know, you know, there's nothing good right now. There's really nothing good. And all of a sudden, I got a call from him later that afternoon saying, where are you? You know, are you on the Upper West Side? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'm on 72nd and Broadway. I need you to come here right now. And I went there. I was like 10 blocks away. And he was there. He was holding a Christmas tree. And it was this enormous Christmas tree. And he's like, I got you something. I need 20 bucks. To be able to buy it. So like I need to borrow $20, but we're going home and we're decorating this tree all night. And that was one of my favorite things. Not only because both of us are Jewish and you know, I don't really have Christmas trees, although I love them, but that was a real act of friendship. That was a real act of empathy. This guy, this really great friend of mine who had never had any experience losing someone very close to him, saw that I was really just struggling. And I didn't know what to do for myself. I was just ambling around the neighborhood. And he said, okay, I need to come up with a task that we can do together where we're just going to focus on something very specific and we can have drinks and we can talk or we can't talk, but Rebecca's going to be with me and I'm not going to let her out of my sight for several hours and then we'll take it from there. That's exactly what he did. And I can't even tell you, years and years later, to me, that's one of the most beautiful shows of friendship and empathy I've ever experienced in my life.
And it's not something you would ever think to ask for. You would never say, what I would love is if you could haul a 9-foot-tall right. Christmas tree down the street for me, carry it up the right. walk up, was it right. 3 floors or something to your apartment? And then
it was nine. It was nine.
Oh, my
floors.
Gosh. Yeah.
And by the way, I had to haul it with him. But, you know, yeah. you're right. I did not think that that is exactly what I needed. No, weirdly, I didn't think that's what I needed. And guess what? It's exactly what I needed. I think it just takes this extra couple of steps of thoughtfulness to consider what you might do for somebody you care about or even you just know, you know, and care about, maybe a coworker. What might they need? What might you need if you were going through a tough time? Maybe do that for them.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marquita Fornoff, sitting in for Carrie Miller. I'm talking today with Rebecca Sofer and Gabrielle Berkner about their new book called Modern Loss. And there's a lot of really solid advice in this book about how to be a good friend, partner, just general human being to someone who's experiencing loss. What's another piece of advice you wish your coworkers or your gym friends, et cetera, had known when your grief felt the most raw? Gabby, I'll turn to you for this one.
I think a piece of advice that is actually more for me than for them, which I would have found helpful if someone else who had experienced grief had told me, really tell people what you need. And that's sort of the opposite of what we were saying is like, do something, don't offer anything. Because it's hard to know. But I wish I was more in a position earlier on to tell people what I need. My father and stepmother were murdered in a home invasion. And most of my friends, I was 24 years old, most of my friends hadn't lost parents. And they hadn't known anyone who was murdered. And so they really wanted to do right by me, but they didn't know how. And so they couldn't possibly intuit what I needed at any given moment. And I felt myself really angry and disappointed. Like, why don't they know what I need? Why don't they show up with this exact type of Chinese food at any given moment or a stack of celebrity weeklies? But when I learned to reach out to my friends who really didn't know what to do, and that's okay, they couldn't possibly know what to do, and asked for the totally idiosyncratic things that I needed at any given moment, just feeling so traumatized, feeling so sad, missing my father and stepmother so much, I felt enormous relief because my needs were actually getting met. My friend Lindsay, I asked her, I'm like, this is so crazy, but I asked her, can you time me on Us Weekly crossword puzzles? And she couldn't possibly have known that's what I needed at any given moment. Like, people are more likely to hand you tissues or offer to anything you need. But when I actually told her, I got my very idiosyncratic needs met.
What was your best time for finishing one of those puzzles?
Oh, God, I wish I could remember. It was 2004, so like it was Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey, Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie. I think we're still friends at the time, so it was that era. But I don't remember my time. I do remember the subject matter, though.
I'm not sure if it's the same for you, but as a Midwesterner, I feel totally uncomfortable asking people for help always. Like, I never want to impose on anyone. And even when something horrific and awful happens, it still feels uncomfortable to be like, could you walk my dog? How do you get that courage to muster up?
I mean, it becomes a choice between getting your needs met and not getting your needs met. And for me, it's like if I wanted to have friends, have a support system, you know, get my dog walked, I knew at some point after just being angry that my friends weren't somehow psychically knowing these things and not doing them, even though they were desperate to help me, I learned to ask. And sometimes it's uncomfortable, but over time it gets less so.
Right. Anger doesn't get the dog walked, unfortunately.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Anger doesn't get the dog walked.
Well, and I imagine after you asked for a very odd or very specific thing and someone said yes, it made it that much easier to ask for another favor. Right?
For sure. You learn to ask what you need. You see that your needs are met and you see that you feel incrementally better after.
I mean, one of the reasons that Modern Loss exists is that Gabby and I became friends by talking about our respective losses. And we had, for some part, in my own life, I had just felt so alone. I was working full time at a daily TV show, which, you know, completely blurs the lines between work and personal space. Mm-hmm. I had very little time on my own to set aside for just like, quote unquote, grieving from like 10 to 11 p.m. Like, this is when I'm grieving. No, everything was just kind of swirled up into each other. And it was really only when I started to meet some other people who I felt really got in some way what I was going through, which was really just the common denominator of grief is a total mess. It's okay if you're not okay. You know, it's okay if it's one step forward, 20 steps back. Like, it's fine. It's totally normal. Don't let anyone make you feel otherwise. And once I started to meet more people like that, I realized that that was what was going to make stating my needs easier, realizing that, you know, I could have these conversations with people. I didn't feel like I had to, you know, be embarrassed about my loss, sweep it under the rug, pretend like it didn't exist, which is what I went to great lengths pretending over the course of the first several months after my mom's death. I didn't know when I should go back to work, if I should go back to work. So I just went back to work. And over the course of several months and really more than a year, that's what it took for me to realize what I needed. And the bottom line was what I needed was to feel comfortable and free in talking about my losses in addition to all the other things in my life and realizing that they did define me in some ways, but they didn't completely define me. And I think that that's just one of the most powerful things that someone who is living with loss can learn, which is that you have the ability to create your own narrative, to tell people what you think happened to you, what you're experiencing. And by extension, when you do that, not only do you feel a little more comfortable stating your needs, but also I think you feel more comfortable and confident around other people because you don't wonder what they're talking about behind closed doors. You know, oh, that's the girl whose mom died in a car crash, or, you know, her dad was murdered. You don't really wonder that because you're more forthcoming about what happened to you and what your experiences are. I'm not talking about, you know, chatting up the guy at the bodega. I'm talking about people who you're close with, who you feel relatively comfortable expressing yourself to. I think that that's, you know, what Modern Loss does. It's a platform. It's a digital platform. It's in real life community. It's now a book. It's events that enable people to open up about their stories and really nail down what their loss narrative is so that others don't do it for them.
And you're never going to find someone who's experiencing the exact same grief as you. But it's helpful to find the communities where there's at least something similar.
Right. Actually, I went back to work 2 weeks after my father and stepmother were murdered, mainly because I had just been spacing out to daytime TV for 2 weeks and didn't know what else to do and thought, okay, I'm going to go back to work. And one of the assistant city editors pointed me towards Safe Horizon, which is a nonprofit in New York City. Safe Horizon helps victims of domestic violence and human trafficking. It also has a wonderful support group and support services for those who have lost someone by violence, lost someone to homicide. And I found myself someplace I never expected to be, which is a church basement. I found myself sitting around the table with a group of mostly women with whom on the surface I had little in common. We were different generations, different faiths, different races. We had different relationships to the people who died. And yet we understood each other and could hear each other in a way that many of our friends outside the group really could not, because there were details of the crimes making their way into news reports. We were having very specific, very horrifying dreams. And I feel like finding people who really understood this forever trauma was incredibly helpful for me. I ended up also joining a national organization called Parents of Murdered Children, which isn't just for parents, but for anyone who lost a loved one to homicide. And I used to go to the conferences every year and watch slideshows of our loved ones on the screen and just be with people who I didn't need to say anything to. They got it. And if I needed to go there, they could hear that. They could witness my pain. And then the group that launched Modern Loss was just a group of five women getting together at a dinner party to talk about losing parents as young adults. It was another kind of support network.
You illustrate what it was like that first gathering so well, where you're saying there was kind of one person that everyone knew, but otherwise the only things you were sure you had in common was that you really loved cheese. all of your sweat glands were working because you were in a hot apartment without air conditioning, and that you had lost someone. But those three things were enough for a foundation of a friendship or a relationship where you guys built your own community.
Yeah, I really feel one of the things I've learned in this process of loss is that beautiful things can form at the intersection of being vulnerable and being empathetic. And that's what I found with my various homicide support groups, and that's certainly what I found with the group, the dinner party group that where Rebecca and I first met.
And I will say, though, piggybacking on that, that it's not to suggest that every group is going to work. One of the reasons I wanted to launch Modern Loss was that I actually still was struggling. I didn't have a Parents of Murdered Children group or a homicide survivor group. I was just a girl who had lost her mom in a car accident. You know, there aren't a lot of groups for that. There at least weren't when I was looking for one. I was just scrambling for a group of people who understood what it was like to lose a parent really suddenly when you were still trying to figure out what you wanted to be when you grew up. And I wasn't 14, so I wasn't going to school and having a guidance counselor who was concerned about me. I just turned 30. I was working full time. I was living in New York City. I really loved life. I was having a great time. I wanted to build a life, meet someone, have kids eventually. And then all of a sudden, everything was abbreviated. It was just cut off very quickly. Not forever, but I certainly thought it was forever. My entire foundation was ripped out from underneath me when my mom died. I had seen her 1 hour and the next hour she was gone. And so I spent a really long time scrambling around. I would go to various support groups. And you know what? They didn't work for me. They didn't work either in terms of age range or really in terms of tone. Modern Loss really prides itself on the fact that our tone is really chatty. It's really candid. It's really messy. It can be a little bit snarky because we still want to feel like we can have gallows humor. We still want to feel like normal human beings. We can't walk around being precious and, you know, sanctimonious all the time because that'll just make us feel like we're not ourselves. I was actually reading this quote from Mark Twain this morning about the, he wrote it for, I think, Following the Equator. And he wrote, the secret sauce, because, you know.
Mark Twain, talking
Mark
about
Twain
secret sauce.
Mark Twain from the 90s. He wrote, the secret source of humor itself is not joy, but sorrow. And that's a pretty astute statement. I mean, Mr. Twain was right on. A lot of humor in life comes from the tough stuff. And we try and recognize that as much as possible. We want our contributors and ourselves to feel like they can crack a joke about a funeral or about a corpse or about, you know, an inheritance process, because this stuff is ludicrous. It is, at any point in time. And you should be allowed to laugh at it. And it's not disrespectful.
Well, and sometimes the only way you can get through these horrible, horrible things is to laugh at it. I think one brilliant example you include in your book is where you're talking about going back to work and the uncomfortable things that people say, either by being way too personal, and you have an illustration of a man saying, was it an open casket? And then there's another woman, and her speech bubble says, so did you catch Real Housewives last night? Like, she's just totally ignoring it altogether. And I imagine that in order to keep getting up each morning, you kind of have to laugh at that.
What are you going to do? I mean, I'm not suggesting, like, hey, your brother just died of leukemia. Have a laugh. But you know what? You can if you want to. It's just more giving people permission to. I think, you know, I had a conversation at the Commonwealth Club a few months ago in San Francisco, and somebody wrote a question during the conversation that I was supposed to answer, asking, you know, is it disrespectful? Should I feel bad that my mom has been dead for 4 months and I was just joking about the funeral process with my brother and my dad overheard us and was really hurt? And my response was no, because this woman really missed her mom. I mean, she really missed her mom a lot. We have different ways of coping, and there is no one right way to grieve. Not just for, you know, every different person, but within yourself. There's no one right way to grieve. You're going to grieve in a million different ways at any point in the game, because you're going to evolve as a human being. And the way you need to grieve today might not be the same way you need it in either tomorrow or a decade from now. So if one of the ways you need is to have a laugh, which is good for you emotionally and physically and mentally, do it. I mean, as long as you're not hurting yourself or somebody else physically, especially, or, you know, emotionally in terms of trying to cause pain, I say you do you. I just think that's, we just need permission to be as messy in grief as we really are in the rest of our lives.
You are listening to NPR News. I'm Markita Fornoff, sitting in for Carrie Miller. Today, I'm joined by Rebecca Sofer and Gabrielle Berkner. Their new book is called Modern Loss. It's a candid conversation about grief. And I want to go back to the element of time here. One of my very best friends lost her significant other, and her therapist warned her about a phenomenon she called the Jell-O Brigade. And it's where people bring you Jell-Os and casseroles and ask how you're doing for the first couple of weeks or maybe months if you're lucky. But once they've moved on from that grief, they expect you to move on from it too. And I think, Gabby, you were talking about this a little bit earlier, where grief is a thing that you live with forever.
Grief is a thing you live with forever. We have a whole chapter in the book called Absence Plus Time, and it really talks about how our grief changes shape over time. It doesn't go away. There's not, you know, quote unquote closure, or you don't get over it or get past it or any of the other
euphemisms or things people ask you or say to you in the aftermath, a year out, 2 years out. There's no set period of time that you stop grieving. And in that chapter, we discuss that sometimes the first year actually has the most cushions for you. People are, you know, there's wakes and shivas and there are casseroles. There are memorial donations. There are cards and calls and people checking in. And then at some point, whether it's a month, 6 months, a year, people move on with their lives. And that's totally understandable. But I think it's also important to understand that the first year isn't necessarily the hardest. For me, in the aftermath of my father and stepmother's murders, it was certainly the most traumatic. It was the most shocking. My body and brain and just whole being was trying to get used to the idea of, one, them not being here, and two, that this happened at the hands of someone else. And it was so far from what my 24 years had prepared me for, medical examiners and mortuaries, police and prosecutors. And I was, you know, I was really in shock that first year, but I really found the second year harder. And I think people at that point expected that I would have some modicum of normalcy at that point, a year out, 2 years out. And I really felt like, yes, the first year is the most traumatic, but the second year, the third year, it really felt more like pure grief to me. And I think it's important to acknowledge that grief is something we live with forever. There's a long arc of grief. And we need to be there and show up and follow up and follow through for the people we love, not just that first month when everyone's bringing casseroles, but a year, but years out.
You still call it grief. And that's okay, right?
You can call it grief. You can call it whatever you want. I don't think, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, neither Gabby nor I are mental health professionals, nor should we be. We are lay people who were dealt a bum deck of cards, like everybody is in their own way. And this is how we have grappled with that deck, you know, in part by our personal struggles, but in addition by launching Modern Loss and co-writing this book along with some pretty amazing contributors. I don't really consider myself as grieving anymore. My mom has been dead for 10 years, and it's still really hard. Since she died, I met a man who I then married. I got a dog who was like my firstborn, who she will never meet. She will never meet my husband. She'll never meet my dog, which is like, that's okay. But, you know, more important, she's never going to meet my kids. I now have two little boys. I have a baby right now. And I still feel her loss so deeply. I feel it so deeply. And sometimes I feel it more deeply when I'm the least expecting it, when my baby starts crawling or he has this smile and it totally reminds me of her. And I just still, 10 years later, I sometimes think, oh, I got to call my mom. But I can't, because that would be weird. And, you know, she's not going to answer the phone. But I don't really think I'm grieving. I think that I live with loss. I think for me, that feels a little bit more empowering for me to describe it like that. For myself, this is my own personal take. I am living with loss hand in hand with living with a lot of other things in my life.
Yeah, it's okay to not be okay is one of the messages that really sticks with you throughout this book. But another thing that I want to highlight really quickly here is that it's okay to grieve complicated relationships. There are some really beautiful essays in this book about finding out your husband cheated on you after his death, but still mourning his loss. And I think that there are so many different types of loss, but it's hard to talk about them in general. And then there's a whole other category that we don't talk about at all.
Right. Like you said, there are different, you know, there's taboo on top of taboo in this book. It's not just talking about grief, which we all know is taboo, right? Still, even though more and more people are talking about it. But it's on top of that, talking about suicide, talking about someone who died from AIDS, maybe, talking about Yeah, like finding out your husband, like, hey, surprise, your husband who died in a scuba diving accident was also having multiple affairs, and you just found out after he died. This all of this is, you know, it's messy. It's easier for people listening to a story to listen to a nice, neat story that's tied up with a bow saying, oh, my husband, I'm 32-year-old widow because my husband, who I was really close with, died when he went scuba diving, and I am mourning him. It's a lot messier, and it puts, you know, a lot more pressure on a listener when you say, you know, I'm all this, but also, guess what? He was totally cheating on me, and I really hate his guts, and I also really miss him, and I really love him, and I kind of hate him. You know, this is just the way it is. This is life. We don't leave things perfectly tied with a bow when we leave this world. And that's what we're trying to put out there.
One thing I like to say is we're all imperfect people, mourning imperfect people imperfectly. We don't do everything right in our lifetimes. We don't do everything right in the course of mourning that person. And that's okay. Like, I think it's important to recognize that the people we lost are human.
So, Gabby, what's your one piece of advice for dealing with the type of loss that there is no Hallmark card for?
To let people know that whatever they are feeling is okay. And I think it's really important to be honest with people and say, if your friend has lost a parent or sibling or spouse or friend, just to say, I really don't know what to say. I want to be there for you. I really, truly feel that if you're honest with people, if you show up, if you continue to call and follow up and follow through and do what you can and enable space for people to talk about their loved one and to enable space in yourself to hear that and witness their grief, that's so much more important than saying the exact right thing at any given moment.
Gabrielle Berkner and Rebecca Sofer, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for having us, Marquita. This has been great.
Marquita Fornoff is the lead producer of this program. She's been talking with the authors of Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief, Beginner's Welcome. The book comes out today. They're coming to town in February, actually. They'll be in St. Paul and an appearance at Subtext Books. They'll be there Thursday, February 15th, for a conversation with Nora McInerney, who hosts the podcast Terrible Thanks for Asking. So if you've enjoyed this conversation and you want to meet the authors, you can do that in St. Paul. Subtext Books, February 15th.